Operation Market Garden, and specifically the crossing of the Wall River that allowed the Allies to capture the bridge at Nijmegen, spared 2 million Dutch citizens that same fate. A number of questions still remain, such as, why weren't reinforcements dropped south of Arnhem in the 11-mile stretch between Nijmegen and Arnhem? Why did Eisenhower agree to the plan? Just to pacify Montgomery? Why wasn't air support called in for the German gun placements at the foot of the Nijmegen Bridge? Why was the British 1st Airborne dropped 8 miles from Arnhem, when past experience had already taught the British that drops needed to be much closer to be effective? And was the plan sabotaged? Our guest today, Tony Gosling, has an interesting take on that. And the story of a double agent, a spy named King Kong. Tony, welcome to 1001 Heroes Podcast. It's great to have you aboard.
Thanks very much for inviting me. Okay, well, I don't buy any of this thing about intelligence failure. I think that the intelligence people knew exactly what was going on, and they knew exactly what the risks were in going ahead with Operation Market Garden, because his name was Brian Urquhart, who was the intelligence officer for the Airborne Corps. He actually was sacked right before the operation took place. He went on to become the Deputy Secretary General of NATO, actually, just after the war. And I understand he's still alive, living in New York, somehow attached to the UN still. But he was basically saying, look, we can't do this. The intelligence that's we've got is that this we should not carry on with this operation because the resistance in Arnhem is going to be too dangerous. And he was sacked for saying that. And I think they wanted to go. They decided they were going to go ahead with the operation, even though they knew what the intelligence risks were. Also, I'd say another chap that I interviewed who was a fantastic contact and a really authoritative source on all of this was the British Army Colonel. I think he's actually a retired British Army Colonel now, Robert Kershaw, who wrote a book called It Never Snows in September. Now, he'd had the unique opportunity to interview German General Heinz Hamel, who was a commander of, I think it was the 10th SS Panzer Division. But anyway, he was operationally in charge of the defense of the Nijmegen and Arnhem area. And it was his job. He was the guy who, in the film A Bridge Too Far, was there to try and blow up the Nijmegen Bridge as the British tanks crossed it. That is the bridge one too far away. And in the piece that I did a few years ago, it's called A Bridge Not Far, I point out was that in the interview that Robert Kershaw did with Heinz Hamel, he was told in no uncertain terms that if you had carried on at that point, it would have been all over for us.
Here's a portion of that Kershaw interview for our listeners.
Once they had captured the bridge, and this is debatable, they could conceivably have pushed an armoured infantry group up the road to reach Arnhem. I interviewed the German SS General, Hamel, who was responsible for the defence of the bridge, and he gave me an artillery map. And artillery maps will always show the location of friendly units. And it's obvious from this particular map and his statement that there was very little on the road between Nijmegen and Arnhem at that time. In fact, there's only a couple of companies of infantry security pickets in the village of Elst, which is midway between the two. So they may have been able to push an armoured battle group up that road. Hamel thinks so, because he very sarcastically said, and the British stopped for tea. And that's the version also that the Americans would have you believe. I'm an armchair strategist talking in hindsight, and he was the man there at the time. If he says that the psychological impact of a unit pushing down that road could have been decisive, then I think you have to listen. That is quite possible.
Now, it's an interesting thing for him to say, typical German, shall we say, double meaning to what he's saying there. He's not just talking about that battle being all over for us. He's talking actually about the war, because Montgomery knew that by getting a bridgehead across the Rhine, this was going to completely compromise the German defences. It would mean that the Ruhr was immediately vulnerable, that loads of the defences from the southern sector on the Western Front were going to have to be moved up to the northern sector to protect the... This was going to cause chaos behind German lines, cut lines of communication, cut lines of supply. And so this really was one of the great, I would say, even crimes of World War II. And I found it quite interesting that the commander on the ground, who was General Horrocks on the market side of the operation, or sorry, the garden side, the market was the airborne operation. Garden was the armored assault along this narrow corridor in towards the Rhine and towards Arnhem. That attack ended up being a failure. And the fact was that if they had pressed ahead, they could have actually captured in Arnhem, they could have captured their main objective. And the British troops just simply didn't do that. I think one of the other things I found fascinating about researching this, I mean, it really did feel like a gold mine going into this research. There was so much being turned up, which it didn't seem anyone before had actually managed to join these dots, was that you also had a queue of US 82nd Airborne officers going to speak to Peter Carrington in his tank at Lent, which is just the north side of the Nijmegen Bridge, once the Nijmegen Bridge had been taken. And they were saying, first of all, it was Captain Moffat Burris, who I interviewed. Then it was about half an hour later, it was Major Cook, his commanding officer. Then from then to Colonel Tucker. And then finally, General Gavin himself, who was the general commanding 82nd Airborne, all went to speak to Carrington. Eventually, Moffat Burris says Carrington actually just went down inside his tank and unlocked the hatch because he was fed up with all these American soldiers trying to force him to carry on down the road. And he could quite easily have carried on down the road as Sergeant Robinson, who was one of Carrington's colleagues in the Grenadier Guards Sherman tanks, crossing the Vaal at Nijmegen. Sergeant Robinson actually charged straight down the road, as Carrington should have done, and a whole of the 30 Corps should have done, to Arnhem to relieve the troops there. And Sergeant Robinson charged into Lent, and a bit further on underneath the railway bridge, went a couple of miles towards Arnhem. It was around about, I think it was around about 11-mile journey, which in those tanks could have been done in around about maybe 25 minutes, and they just decided not to do it. But Robinson was pretty much totally successful in one tank on his own in blasting his way right the way through Lent and out the other side. And this interview, as I mentioned, with Robert Kershaw, Heinz Hamel said that all there was, and he shows the evidence for this in the artillery map from the war, that all there was in Elst, which was a little village halfway across the island from the Vaal to the Rhine, that is from Nijmegen to Arnhem, was just a few security pickets armed with rifles. So there was really nothing to stop them. So I think that summing up what happened there was, by failing to bring the armoured reinforcements up to Arnhem, that is to say a corps of tanks. We're not just talking about the Grenadier Guards. The Irish Guards were sitting there waiting to go. Some of the Coldstream Guards were engaged still in the Grosbeak Heights. There were certainly coming on for 100 or so tanks which could have been sent down that road that evening, and they weren't. So the reason they weren't, I would suggest, was that this wasn't just an accident, that somebody somewhere didn't want this mission to succeed.
When you start to research it, it really does look like that. He sat there blocking up that entire 30 Corps for 18 hours, and that cost Frost everything up in Arnhem. He had surrendered during that time that they sat there. It's just a shame that that happened.
It's far worse than that. I mean, Frost himself was really angry. And at one of the reunions before he died, he was the commander in charge of, I think it was the 2nd Battalion of the 1st Airborne Division, the troops that were holding the bridge at Arnhem. He was listening to a speech by someone from the Grenadier Guards, Carrington or somebody else who was at the reunion, and he shouted at the top of his voice, "Call that fighting," and threw his fist up in the air. He was even to his dying day, was really angry that that the other contingents of the British Army. And I remember hearing a story from a military historian here in Britain about British Army meetings to this day, where the airborne troops that go to these meetings and airborne commanders that turn up to meet, you know, places like Aldershot, Warminster, Amesbury, the places where the British Army are these days. That if they go to a meeting between people who are tank commanders and airborne commanders, the airborne commanders always turn up a little bit early to the meeting. And so they sit there, and when the tank commanders come in, they say, "Oh, you're late again, are you?" Because they're referring back to this incident at Arnhem. And, I think it, in a way it shows that Gavin and the 82nd Airborne were really doing their job. They were absolutely 100% on the mission. And they believed that it was possible, and of course it was possible, to have to taken the bridge at Arnhem and held Arnhem. And I spoke to Tony Hibbert directly. He was one of the a brigade major at the bridge who survived the war, and he died only just a couple of years ago. And when I spoke to him, he said that everybody on that mission knew that if they could succeed in holding that bridge, the war would be finished by Christmas time. They'd looked at all of the, certainly the senior people had seen just what a state the Germans would have been in if they'd have taken Arnhem. And they just failed to do that because of a complete failure of the tanks to come along at the right time. And all sorts of excuses have been put up over the years to say why Horrocks did that. He was the commander of the ground troops. Why did he just simply sit around? Lots of excuses have been used, but none of them really holds water.
Horrocks seemed to be in league with Carrington. Horrocks, of course, was Carrington's command officer. And Horrocks was approached, too, from what I understand. And he said that they didn't have enough ammunition, basically had a pretty weak excuse.
Well, there was another excuse which is often trotted out, which is that that the dikes were very narrow and at night time it would be very difficult to maneuver. Another one was that tanks would be easy to pick off. Well, the fact of the matter is that they're at night. It's actually a lot easier. And in another interview that he did at some point during World War II, Horrocks is quoted as saying that he favoured the night assault. And that he knew that the Germans were more vulnerable at night. So he used to enjoy, it's probably not the right word, but he actually used to like to deploy his troops at night, knowing that the Germans would be off their guard. As for the ammunition, well, we know that the particular troops that had come across, I mean, this is specific and well known, actually, the particular tank troops that had come across from the Grenadier Guards over the Nijmegen Bridge were actually the reserve of that unit. So they hadn't actually fired any ammunition, and they had at full ammunition tanks or whatever. You know, I don't know exactly what goes on inside a Sherman tank and where the shells are, whether they're high explosive, armor piercing or whatever in there, but they certainly hadn't been being used in the assault on the bridge. They were the strategic reserve, and once the bridge had been taken, they were the ones to become the spear to move across the bridge. There's also this interesting aspect to it, was is the bridge going to be blown up or not? And I think there's a backstory to this, in that there was a conflict going on between Adolf Hitler and his Reichsfuhrer, who was effectively his controller, his treasurer, Martin Bormann. And Hitler had ordered that there must be a slash and burn policy, and this was supposed to have been promulgated in August 1944, that they would destroy all bridges, destroy all buildings. But the thing is, Bormann was secretly in communication with some of the Allies, and they had come to an arrangement whereby as much as possible would be handed over intact. So this was one of the first times that major orders by Adolf Hitler had been countermanded secretly by Bormann. And so I do wonder whether actually that there was something going on where Bormann was getting his way, that the bridge wasn't blown up at Nijmegen. Importantly, we keep getting told about Market Garden that the Germans managed to find the plans, and that it was in a glider that crashed that they got the plans from. Well, I've heard various stories about where this glider was, different stories. None of them actually seem to be easily corroborated. It's much simpler, I think. I think that's effectively a cover story, because I came across a book which was written in the 1950s by a British Army intelligence colonel who was actually, I think, a Dutch national, but he wrote a book or wrote a chapter of his book was called Spycatcher, but the chapter was called The Traitor of Arnhem. And he had interrogated a Dutch underground, what they called a recce commander, a guy called Christian Lindemans, known under the code name of King Kong, who was supposedly one of the great underground commanders. The only thing was, quite often he would send his partisans, effectively, partisans in to do a raid on the Germans. Lots of people would get killed, and only he would survive. He was a very big guy, and it turns out that he was actually, as Pinto discovered just before the Battle of Arnhem, he was working for the Abwehr. And he'd begun to discover this. He was on the trail of this as an intelligence officer. Absolutely brilliant bit of work by Oreste Pinto. And at which time he was taken out of his command. So in other words, he was beginning to interrogate this guy, but suddenly he was spirited away because he was going to be involved in Arnhem. And he was sent in to Arnhem, apparently to make contact with the Dutch underground. He was parachuted in, I believe, before the battle took place, or he may have been spirited across enemy lines. I'm not sure, you know, the sort of no man's land. But anyway, the fact was, rather than go and help warn the Dutch underground that this attack was coming, he went straight to the Abwehr and delivered over what he knew just a few days before the battle took place. So I think it's a little bit rich to think that, the Germans just came across a load of plans which just happened to be sitting in a glider. Well, it's very unlikely that the plans would have been just sitting in a glider. You know, that it was well known that gliders can be shot down and that people might, you know, so the plans are very unlikely to be somewhere like that.
No, I agree with you. There's a lot of research out there that praises the Germans for their ability to respond so fast to this attack. But in actuality, when you really start to look at it, it seems in many ways as if they had were expecting it and were starting to position those troops even before
the paratroops dropped out of those planes. Well, this whole idea of the 9th and 10th SS Panzer Division on the outskirts of Arnhem just happening to be hanging around, they were moved there just a few days beforehand, and it could well have been they were moved out there on the intelligence gained from King Kong, you know, by the Abwehr, saying, well, look, if this is going to happen, we want to make sure we've got the big guns hanging around.
You've interviewed some very key players, among them Moffat Burris of the 82nd Airborne and Brigade Major General Tony Hibbert, who was with Frost's division in Arnhem. What were their feelings regarding Montgomery and British High Command?
I think generally, it's almost like the sheep and the goats when it comes to Arnhem. People either can see this or they can't, and they try and stick to the, I think, completely erroneous historical record, or they admit that they've had the wool pulled over our eyes here for a long, long time. I mean, all you need to do is look at some of, I mean, for example, like I said about Brian Urquhart's resignation as the intelligence officer, should have been alarm bells ringing there. Also, the appalling behaviour of General Boy Browning, who was the commander of all three airborne divisions in Market Garden. Terrible behaviour. He didn't seem to take any interest in the battle whatsoever. First of all, he didn't even go to the key objective. He went to Nijmegen, which was the secondary bridge. He wouldn't go to Arnhem. I think maybe he knew that it was going to be a rather bloody battle there. And so, you know, no real courage shown by him. Not only that, he then spent most of his time between two different things. One was diverting General Gavin from the 82nd away from the main objective, which was the bridge, towards a bogus objective, which was the Grosbeek Heights. He was saying, well, we've got to take the Grosbeek Heights before we take the bridge. And Gavin went along with this, you know, because he was a senior officer saying that you've got to go for the Grosbeek Heights. This allowed the Germans to get into the bridge at Nijmegen and reinforce it, and meant that it was a horrendous battle to actually take the bridge, which was his main objective. So he was doing that. But the other thing he was doing was tooling around in his Jeep, and he took a whole load. I think it was something like 20 gliders worth of headquarters. So a lot of that is just luxury. It's things like kitchens and, you know, this kind of nice luxury staff for his headquarters. But he got his Jeep and he started tooling around that whole area. And in fact, he even drove up to the Grosbeek Heights, because this was the border with Germany, so that he could be photographed for the British newspapers as the first British officer general to be urinating on German soil. So this guy was not a serious character. After the war, he was an alcoholic, actually. And he was married to the writer Daphne du Maurier, and he was put in charge of the finances of the royal family. But he was a very unhappy man, and I think he was just kind of disturbed by it all. The other thing Browning did is he tried to put the blame for Market Garden onto, in a very cowardly fashion, onto General Sosabowski, who's the Polish commander, who are actually incredible. These Poles were absolutely misdeployed. They could have quite easily have been parachuted in on the Tuesday, potentially, maybe on the Wednesday of Market Garden, onto the bridge to reinforce Frost. These Poles were absolutely gunning to have a go at the Germans, particularly after what had happened to their countrymen, you know, in Warsaw, etc. And so they were an incredibly, they would have, could have been the ace in the hole for that operation, but they were completely misdeployed by being parachuted into the wrong place at the wrong time. And then they were blamed for the errors of Browning. So he really does come out as the worst commander here. I mean, I just to compare with the Bond writer Ian Fleming, who was in naval intelligence during the war. He also, after the war, became an alcoholic, but he dealt with it. You know, he became a writer of fiction because he knew the things that he knew about what had happened in World War II were disturbing him, and he started to drink. And so he turned his energy into writing fiction because he knew that you couldn't be done under the Official Secrets Act for revealing secrets if you're writing it in a fiction book. And he found a way to kind of get, but Browning never did that. And I think he is really one, along with Carrington. Browning and Carrington are the two main people I think were responsible for that failure. The end result of the failure was allowing another 4 or 5 months for the Nazis to squirrel away their wealth, because this program was well in train. The recrudescence of the Nazis after World War II, they wanted to make sure all of the money that had been collected in Berlin, all of the wealth, all everything. I mean, we're talking about paintings, we're talking about gold, we're talking about securities, we're talking about bearer bonds, a massive wealth, something at the time of well over $1 billion worth of wealth. And they began on a program in August 1944 of squirreling that away around the world. And so the failure of Market Garden gave them the time to do that. And Bormann was a key character in that. He was the guy who he held the keys to the Nazi bank accounts. In fact, Ian Fleming even flew to Switzerland to talk to the Swiss intelligence. And just as he was leaving, having not got very far, they gave him a piece of paper with a number on, which he, when he got back to London, found was Martin Bormann's Nazi Party membership number.
I hadn't heard that one. Who was Prince Bernhard?
Yeah, well, he was also responsible for this. He was the guy that sent in the he was actually originally a Nazi. He was in the SS in the 1930s, but then he married into the Dutch royal family and supposedly gave up any connections with the Nazi party. And then he came to London, and he was, you know, with the Dutch royal family in exile, went to Canada with his wife, Queen Juliana. And he was very much involved in Market Garden planning. And a lot of people would say he was the, you know, he was basically the conduit for the spy, King Kong, Christian Lindemans. Yeah, yeah. And as the Dutch liaison officer for the operation, there are some intriguing photographs of Montgomery and General Horrocks with Prince Bernhard stood there looking over their shoulders at the Market Garden plans. So I think the Germans were all over this operation. They knew exactly what was about to happen, and they had managed formally on the ground, rather than using secret communications of any sort, to actually get physically to get plans through King Kong, through Christian Lindemans, who, by the way, was bumped off very quickly after the end of the war, so that he couldn't ever tell anyone about his role, straight to the Abwehr, straight to the German army. I mean, I have to say one thing I have to say about, and it's fascinating talking to Robert Kershaw, the colonel, the British Army colonel, who was over in Germany talking to these German generals before they died. Hamel and Harzer, I think it was, Model and the rest of them, Bittrich, were playing a very, very, very good defensive battle, very, very good defensive game. They were really stopping the advance of the Allied armies at every turn. But the thing is that this particular time, it looks like they had help from our side. And it looks as if at that point, that was a key factor in allowing Nazis to actually survive the war, you know, in a financial way. And I've had more than one person say to me, well, it looks now as if the Nazi empire is composed of banks, not tanks, and they take over using ordinary kind of, they buy you up, they buy you out, which is just as effective as blasting you with a tank and getting rid of you that way. In fact, in a way, using money to buy people out and to take them over in a hostile takeover is more powerful, because you can do it almost anywhere. Having read the two key books about, I think, the end game of World War II, which is, one of which is John Ainsworth Davis, he writes under the pen name of Christopher Crichton, it's called Op JB, and the other one is actually CBS journalist Paul Manning. He was the guy reporting on the Western Front for CBS during World War II, and he wrote a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. You can start to put together the pieces of why someone would want to sabotage such a deft attack, which is what this was. I mean, it was a really well-aimed punch, and really that was to secrete much of the Nazi wealth over in South America and Switzerland, then launder it through Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, that's Alan Dulles' law firm in New York, and invest it into 750 companies, which Martin Bormann over in South America, Paul Manning says, created. And those companies then had former SS officers, former SS people, and Jewish people made directors of those firms. And the idea of putting Jewish people on the firms was that no one would ever suspect that this firm could have been put together by Nazis and be effectively a kind of Nazi front in the world today.
One thing I wanted to go back to is General Sosabowski. He was played extremely well by Gene Hackman in the movie A Bridge Too Far, when Sosabowski approached Browning and said, "Listen, this plan is suicide." And Browning, of course, shut that down pretty quickly. And I think Browning pretty much gave him his retribution when he told the Polish paratroops that there just weren't enough planes to take them over there, and finally did end up dropping them right on top of German guns. When they did drop them, I think all that was just to get back at Sosabowski. Whatever happened to Sosabowski after the war, do you know?
Well, he died a pauper, which is horrific. And I remember chatting to Tony Hibbert about him. In fact, I put up a YouTube film with Hibbert, who was 1st Airborne Division Brigade Major. At the bridge, and he said that he thought that the British Army should formally apologize to the Polish Army and to Sosabowski's family about what happened, because it was such an appalling thing to do. I mean, really totally inexcusable to blame. And I think, in a way, if I'd have been the Browning or a commander on the day, I would have seen the Poles as your ultimate shock troops, really, for any kind of emergency or difficult situation like there was in Arnhem. These are the perfect troops to drop right on top of the situation, who would absolutely make the best of that fight to reinforce Frost at the bridge. And they never did that. They did the total opposite. They just put them in the way of the German guns, as you said. So we've gone way beyond this being an accident or a mistake. This is quite obvious that there are deliberate attempts to make sure that the Rhine bridgehead doesn't happen. And I think to this day, we deserve, this whole episode needs to be looked at properly, deserve a complete revision of it being a bridge too far, because it wasn't a bridge too far. It was a bridge very, very close. And let's just bear in mind that the German general on the day, who was there commanding the defences of Arnhem and Nijmegen, made it absolutely clear that if they had just carried on from the bridge where Carrington was, then it would have been all over. And I think that's absolutely clear now. You can see all the evidence that he's 100% correct to say what we would have had was a column of Sherman tanks pouring up the road straight into Arnhem. And I'm afraid that the Germans up there would, I mean, there may have possibly been two Tiger tanks for them to have dealt with, which is not an easy task for a Sherman to deal with two Tiger tanks. But they had, of course, they had the 82nd Airborne, who were actually jumping on the tanks, who would have come along with them and had, some anti-tank capability, but the tanks themselves, I'm sure they could have dealt with two Tigers, because they were crossing the Arnhem Bridge in a southerly direction at about around about the same time as Sergeant Robinson was charging into Lent and blasting away. He took out, I think it was a self-propelled gun, was the only main, the only defence that there was, apart from the bridge itself at Nijmegen, because that was the defence, and there wasn't anything else. So they took out that one self-propelled gun. You have to remember that it was impossible for the Germans to get things across, to reinforce across the Arnhem Bridge, because the British were still defending it at that point. What they were having to do was they had to take all their heavy equipment down to the Pannerden ferry. They were trying to get it across the ferry bit by bit. I mean, it's a really difficult thing to do, to get a tank on a ferry. And it was, it was excruciatingly impossible to get everything, so they couldn't. And they were, even though they were getting troops across on the ferry, this is these SS soldiers from the Panzer Division across, Panzer Grenadiers, they had to then march everywhere and walk everywhere. They hadn't got their transport they were supposed to have, so they're having to do everything on night marches and things like that. So it was an absolute chaos situation for the Germans, who were putting all of their efforts into attacking the British in Arnhem, and they had virtually nothing left for Nijmegen. So it's quite clear that the battle, that's at Nijmegen, which is where the battle was lost, not in Arnhem. Well, and deliberately so.
Tony, I thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I think we very, very much agree that there was a lot more going on behind the scenes with Operation Market Garden. I'd just
say one thing, because this Assault River crossing by the 82nd was one of the great moments of the Second World War. Really incredible, almost reckless bravery to take that bridge. For them to then have the British generals Browning and Horrocks throw that back in their face was just absolutely appalling. One of the things, I mean, in a way, I think the British should be apologizing to the American army for that one incident.
I agree with you. And you know, the movie Heartbreak Ridge was big. They should have Heartbreak Bridge, because that's the whole thing behind this story, is how much sacrifice was made to get to that point, and then to have it basically sabotaged by British command. Just unbelievable story.
And finally, just that the piece that I wrote about it is up on the Russia Today website. It's that is to say the summary of the research that I did. It's called A Betrayal Too Far, Only Brutal Honesty Will Do at Arnhem's 70th Anniversary. So I wrote that for the 70th anniversary, which, of course, for many of the people participants, even in their sort of 80s and 90s, would have been the last possible time that people would have gone back to Arnhem to commemorate the Market Garden. And the interviews with Robert Kershaw and Moffat Burrows are on our show page, which is thisweek.org.uk, and that's the Friday Drive Time program that we did, and also A Bridge Not Far on YouTube.
Thank you. Is there any more contact information you want to give people who might want to get back in touch with you with questions?
Anyone that wants to get hold of me can find me via bilderberg.org at the contact page. That's my email address, is tony@cultureshop.org.uk. That's S-H-O-P, cultureshop, one word, .org.uk. You'll find my phone number on there too, so you can drop me a text or give me a call, so long as it's a sensible time of day. Always happy to chat with people, or email. It might be easier, though. But, you know, I think the thing is, you know, this is unfinished business, because we're still having to deal with the crooks, the Allied traitors that sabotaged this operation back in September 1944. And next time we deal with this massive fascist crime empire, we're going to have to make a proper job of it.
I couldn't agree with you more. Tony, thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Of course, it's very easy to look over the what caused the failure after the event and put your hand on it, but in the middle of the event itself, it's quite different. Everyone felt that the lack of aggression of 30 Corps to achieve its objectives, even within some reasonable time of what was thought to be possible, had a great deal to do with the failure. The airdrop was not sufficient, of course, to carry out a plan like this the way we'd have liked. You always want more than you can get. In theory, of course, and I think this would be a principle in any airborne operations from now on, you must drop all your combat troops at one time. And you must drop them near the objective and not 6 or 8 miles away, as Urquhart did in the drops at Arnhem. His main landing areas were, I think, 6 miles to the west. And it just doesn't work. You've got to take your losses and drop it on the target.
Well, my task was to take the 3 bridges leading into across the Rhine at Arnhem on that first afternoon. And we got, after a certain amount of skirmishing and meeting a few Germans on the way from the dropping zone to the bridges, we actually got onto the railway bridge when it was blown by the enemy in our faces.
We knew at that time the opposition was not going to be very great, and we thought we really shouldn't have much difficulty. Our difficulty possibly would be to get there at all in face of the enemy of air opposition. We never recovered from the fact that we had to land some 7 or 8 miles away from our objective. Now, that was a major factor in really determining the fate of that particular operation. It was far too far. Second was that the lifts did not come in, as we hoped, on time because of weather and for other reasons. The third one was, I think another major one, was that the Second Army didn't manage to get up to us in the time which was originally hoped for. We thought we would be joined within 2 days or 3 days at the very most, but in fact, as things turned out, we eventually stayed ourselves north of the river for some 9 days.
Der schwerste Fehler, das zu weit.
The greatest mistake was that they jumped too far away. I call it hedging along the horizon. That's what I said to my own parachutists. Just as General Gavin said, as he wrote in his book, I told them you must, under no circumstances, hedge along the horizon. You must, under all circumstances, you must get hold of the target in a hand-to-hand battle, even if that involves losses. These losses pay back handsomely later on. Arnhem was the proof.